Welcome to Trust Tree Talks, a podcast that connects a tribe of kick-ass women doing what it takes to make their lives shine. We're your hosts, Elizabeth Holmes
and Lisa Schauer.
Thanks for tuning in. We're so glad you're here. We hope you listened to our first two episodes in season two of Trust Tree Talks as we explored our personal recovery plans for resetting our new normal. We're uncomfortable adapting, changing, and transforming during an unprecedented pandemic, an economic collapse, racial reckoning, and a real fear of what's coming next. During this season, we'll continue to introduce you to women who are innovating and finding new pathways forward as we reflect, reimagine, and reset our lives. We never grow tired of sharing Reese Witherspoon's quote, "We are changing the stories by changing the storytellers." And we intend to highlight the extraordinary stories found in every woman that challenges us to think, nourishes our soul, and energizes our bodies.
We are packing a lot into this episode and profiling two dynamic and creative sisters committed to sharing stories of strong, empowered, and passionate women from all disciplines and walks of life. Amy and Nancy Harrington have made a career based on their love of pop culture. As writers, they create positive entertainment content for their own website, Pop Culture Passionistas. Their interviews, articles, and trivia challenges have been syndicated to Yahoo, OMG, Fox.com, GetBack.com, ScreenPicks, BeliefNet, Examiner, Eco Salon, and many more. Throughout their partnership, they have been associated with some of the greatest pop culture icons and brands in history. As Media Minds creative directors, writers, and project managers, they helped to create the official Hollywood Walk of Fame app. Amy and Nancy curated content from the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, extensive archives, generated bios and facts for the celebrities along the walk, and penned a trivia game of over 500 questions. In 2012, Amy and Nancy were invited to be part of the VIP digital press corps covering Oprah's Life Class. The elite group of seven digital media writers were handpicked by OWN to provide exclusive behind-the-scenes coverage during Winfrey's tour of the U.S. and Toronto. They are the founders of the Passionistas Project, and these women are doing it all. They have a podcast, a blog, and a subscription box profiling women-owned and women-made products. They've been on red carpets at some of the TV's biggest events, including the Emmys, the Television Hall of Fame, and nights honoring the best shows and brightest stars. They have interviewed more than 1,400 pop culture icons, from artists, musicians, actors, producers, and more, about projects, passions, achievements, and inspiration. Welcome, Amy and Nancy. Thank you for joining us on Trust Tree Talks.
Before we get into the Passionistas Project, which we love, we wanted to back up a little bit and hear about where you come from, where you grew up, kind of what were your paths that led you to where you're at today?
We grew up in a town called Braintree, Massachusetts, which was the home of several presidents. It's about 20 miles south of Boston. So we're Boston girls, really. We slip into the accent once in a while. You'll probably hear it. And the family lore is that right before I went to kindergarten, I ordered a baby from my mother because I didn't want her to be lonely when I went away to school. And so a few months later, my baby Amy was born. And we have been best friends ever since. So we were indoor kids. We watched a ton of television together, played games. You know, we spent our childhoods together. Most of the kids in the neighborhood were older than us, so there weren't a lot of other kids in the neighborhood. So, you know, we've been best friends since day one, literally. And then I went off to college. I went to BU. So I wasn't very far away. It was kind of a deal I made with my mother that if I didn't leave the state, she would let me live in a dorm at BU. So I got the college experience, but I could go meet my mother for lunch down the street at her office. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. And then after college, I became a graphic designer. I started my own graphic design business. I did that for a long time. I also had a theater company in Boston. So I kind of, that's where I sort of learned my production chops. My husband was a composer, and he wrote a few musicals, and we thought, well, let's just put them on ourselves. So we had a theater for a few years. And then in around 2000, after Amy had already been out here for 10 years bugging me to come join her. Rob and I moved to Los Angeles. And I, at that point, for the first time in my life, needed to get a full-time job. I had always been self-employed. Wasn't thrilled about the idea of working for someone else, but I did it. And I took a job at an advertising agency that did the Academy Award campaigns for Paramount Classics and Miramax. So, yes, I, a few steps removed, worked for Harvey Weinstein. I never had to deal with him myself, although I dealt with the repercussions of him very often. He was very demanding, and it was a really stressful job. And to the point where after a few years, I was like, I've had enough, and I was ready to move on. And coincidentally, at the same time, Amy was too. So I'll let her tell her story and she'll meet me on the other end.
See you in a minute, man. We grew up in a really creative family. Our dad owned an advertising agency. Our oldest sister, Beth, is a filmmaker. Our brother was in a band. Our sister was a dancer. You know, we were encouraged to be creative, luckily. So I followed Nancy to BU a few years later because I pretty much follow Nancy wherever she goes. Luckily, she's not sick of me yet. And I studied film and television production. I had two great internships this summer before I graduated. So I got to work at MTV for a few weeks. And then the day they found out that the show I was working on was getting canceled, I got a call to come to California to do the Television Academy Foundation internship, which was really amazing. And it showed me that being a girl from Braintree, Massachusetts, I could move to Hollywood and have a career. And I met a bunch of people, which was great. So after I graduated, I literally, 2 days after I graduated, I went downstairs to my parents and said, you need to take me to buy a car tomorrow because I'm going to drive cross country by myself and move to California. And after I picked them up off the floor and got my sister Lisa to come with me across on the drive, I moved to LA and really was fortunate. About a week after I moved here, I got my first job on the TV show Matlock. And I came here wanting to be a sitcom writer. That had been my dream. I wanted to be Sally Rogers from the Dick Van Dyke Show. And I had a professor who gave me really good advice, which was, don't be so sure that you know what you want to do, because there's a lot of really amazing opportunities out there and you might love something else. Even though I didn't like him very much, I thought it was good advice. And so I took the job on Matlock doing post-production, which was the last thing in the world I ever thought I would want to do. But I think partly because I had amazing bosses who were really fun and creative and really taught me so much, I loved it. And I moved from there into visual effects, which I didn't realize was kind of this bubbling passion from when I saw Star Wars as a kid. But I fell into the world of visual effects on the movie Coneheads, another classic. And and I, from there, went with my boss on Coneheads to Warner Brothers, which became my home for 10 years. And we started by working on Lois and Clark and then building an in-house visual effects company for Warner Brothers, the first company of that kind that Warner Brothers had. So we worked on, we started to do big effects for like the Batman movies, things like that. And ultimately, the head of post-production at the studio, at Warner Brothers Studio, asked me to come and work for him. I started as a director of visual effects, but he ultimately promoted me to vice president of post-production and visual effects. So in that job, I worked on every feature film Warner Brothers did for 8 years. And oversaw the teams of people who were the, you know, visual effects, sound, music, editing, oversaw those teams on the Harry Potter movies, the first three Harry Potter movies, 2.5 Harry Potter movies, the Matrix movies, Perfect Storm, You've Got Mail, every movie that Warner Brothers distributed and produced for about 8 years in that job. And then there were some political changes that happened and they weren't the direction I wanted to go in. And at the time, like Nancy said, she was wanting to get out of her situation. And a friend actually wanted to start a television network, which we knew nothing about. And this was when like someone would say the word Bluetooth in a meeting and we would all be like, what is that? I have no idea what you're talking about. Wi-Fi?
What is this thing you call
Wi-Fi? And so we were both like, let's go start this television network and quit our full-time, you know, fantastic, envious careers and take the leap. So that's what we did.
That's incredible. That's a huge job. Both of you had such big jobs. I mean, it's a huge job. Amy and Nancy, like your batting average of what was winning Academy Awards had to be like 900 or something.
I worked for Miramax at that period of Chicago and all those. Yeah, they were like winning everything.
The more
he won, the more stressful the job got.
I, on the other hand, worked at Warner Brothers where literally every movie was like, I mean, Warner Brothers was the biggest action movie, biggest studio at the time, really groundbreaking. But every movie I worked on The Postman, the Kevin Costner movie. Not sure if you remember it.
Yeah.
And I would go to what's called a director's cut screening, where the director shows his version of the film for the first time. And those screenings were like 15 people. And I swear to God, we walked out, all of us, like weeping. The heads of the studio, these grown, tough men, were like, "That is the most beautiful movie." It was an amazing movie. And then they kept editing it. And it was like, oh my God, it just got worse and worse. And every movie that we worked on for like 3 of the 8 years I was in that position was like, this is going to be the greatest movie ever. And then it would come out and it would be like, oh, no one likes that. That's really weird. So the only Oscars that I was associated with are the first Matrix won 4 Oscars in the categories that were in under our department. So that was exciting.
That's fantastic.
It was a long run of bad movies while I was at Warner Brothers.
But like Keanu, I mean,
baby.
Right?
Don't even get me started.
Oh my God, I told my daughter he might be your stepdad.
Yeah.
I'm married.
Yeah, he's my hero.
Yeah.
I'm putting it out there in a secret kind of way.
Like. Could happen.
You never know.
Yep. He's age appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he dates age appropriate, which I appreciate.
Yep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for the two of you to be women in film in Hollywood? What experiences did the two of you have?
I was actually really fortunate because in the advertising world, my direct boss was a woman and most of my colleagues were gay men. So I was really fortunate that I didn't run into a lot of sexism and a lot of, you know, I really didn't have any problems to speak of. I mean, I definitely had problems with my boss, but not in that area.
You know, I still look back and think I was really fortunate. I was really young. I was 27 when I became vice president, and I was often the only woman or one of a couple or few women in the room. I always had amazing male mentors who always made me their partner. So I think I came with a level of protection and respect from that, and then earned my own respect by working hard and doing a good job. I never had I only had one maybe Me Too moment, but I got out of it so fast that I never really luckily had to figure out whether it was or not. What happened with me is I definitely feel like I hit the glass ceiling. When the political shift happened, they took my area away from the boss I worked for and moved it under somebody else who had been my equal. It was a really kind of weird moment. But that said, I would say 90% of the people that I worked with, 95% of the men that I worked with at the studio always treated me with respect. And frankly, some who didn't would come back much later. I remember one guy in particular who came and apologized to me because he said, "I don't always treat you the way I treat the guys. And that's not right because you deserve it, you know." So I was really lucky and I am eternally grateful. But I do feel like maybe if I had been there 5 years later, I wouldn't have ended up in the situation I was in. I think things might be a little bit different now than they were then. But I'm glad, frankly, because it was the thing that made me move on and I wouldn't go back for anything in the world.
I'm surprised and pleasantly surprised that you didn't have those experiences. You see the headlines today of what it's like to be a woman in Hollywood and it's a little scary. And so I think you were able to achieve and to be seen and heard, and you didn't have some of the baggage that unfortunately I think there's a lot of women today that are carrying from their time in film.
And I'll be perfectly honest, like, I had meetings in hotel rooms. That was what, you know, if you're on a location in London and you have to meet a producer about, you know, a meeting the next day, you're both in the hotel, you go to the hotel. Like, it never was a thing. I didn't do it a lot, but I did it. Like, you know, it could have been really bad, but I was really lucky that I was around the good guys. And, you know, I think, like I said, I think I established a relationship with them where I was really, really like focused on, I am not going to be a girl. I'm going to be one of the guys. I'm going to, like, you know, and I know that doesn't mean someone's not going to do something inappropriate, but it was really like a focus for me of like, I got to fit in with the guys or they're going to sink me within months. So I was really conscious of that.
I can see, especially being so young, elevated to that position, that that would be almost a defensive stance.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And I felt like an imposter 90% of the time. So it was constantly just like, I just got to, you know, be one of the guys and go out and have a beer on the road and, you know, fit in. And, you know, like, again, like I said, over time, I earned their respect. But with each new person, it was like, okay, here we go again. You know.
Okay. So you are taking the leap together. You are Thelma and Louise-ing it, and you start a television network. Just like Oprah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, us and Oprah, yeah. That didn't quite work out as well for us as it did for her.
Sick of that happening.
Tell us about that.
It was actually a great idea. This friend of ours, she wanted to start a parenting network. And this was in 2002. It was when cable was still, you know, very popular. There was no, I think the DVR had just been invented. They were just developing the capability to put video content on websites. And we kept thinking, what if we just shoot some stuff and put it on a website? And Lisa just had this enormous dream. Like, she wanted to go big or go home. And we worked and worked and worked for several years. And it was a great idea. We had a whole slate of show ideas. Mm-hmm. We had all sorts of people on board, and we just couldn't raise the money. Because it just, that wasn't the way the industry was heading. So people weren't investing in cable networks anymore. Instead, you know, people were buying up a bunch of them and conglomerating them all into companies. So she just couldn't get it off the ground. But what it did do was give Amy and I a few years to realize the talents that we had together and how we balanced each other so well, and that we knew no matter what, we had each other's backs. And so we were going to move forward and do something on our own. So that's what we did. We had a couple of different like consulting kind of gigs and all sorts of different things for a few years. And we had one job together where we created content for a pop culture website. And we produced a daily called Retro Minute. It was a daily show about what was happening in history from the 60s to the 90s on that day. And so we got a lot of experience on that website. And then the problem with that was it was 2008. So that website just did not survive. But once again, a huge learning experience, and we picked ourselves up. And that's when we really said, okay, let's stop working for other people and do this ourselves. So we started the Pop Culture Passionistas. And that's when we started using the producing skills and the interview skills we had picked up and the website stuff we had just learned, and we kind of rolled it all together. We started our own website, we took on some clients, and we started writing pop culture content and doing interviews. And one of our biggest clients was the Television Academy. And a woman named Karen Herman hired us and quickly became our mentor. She brought us into the Television Academy archives, it was called at the time. Now it's the interviews. But they do these 3 to 4 hour long, in-depth archival interviews with people in the television industry. So I think our first one was Melissa Gilbert from Little House on the Prairie, which Amy used to have these big, giant, long braids when she was little that we would braid for her every day. So Melissa Gilbert was like our hero.
Yeah.
and so, we spent the next few years working with Karen and doing in the last 10 years, we've done about 65 or 70 of those interviews. And they're really in-depth. They start with what was your name at birth? They end with how do you want to be remembered? You cover their entire career in between. They're amazing interviews. And they're with celebrities, but also behind the camera people, stunt women and writers and producers and, you know, makeup people. So they're really amazing. And what that taught us was that we really loved doing interviews. And so we spent a lot of time doing that. And then that led us into Passionistas Project.
When you're doing the interviews together, have you developed, I don't know what the interviewing equivalent would be of like good cop, bad cop, or like, or is one of you technical and one color commentary?
Or? It's interesting. When we do the Academy interviews, it's the only time that we don't actually do the interview together. We have to trade off. So Nancy will do one, then I'll do one. But our deal has always been, yes, but we both have to go to them, because if one of us got to go and the other didn't, it would be like, what do you mean? I have a major fear of missing out, being the youngest of five. So we know, and honestly, when we do our own interviews, we're both good cop. Because for us, it's really, it's about making people look good. It's about letting them tell whatever story they want to tell. And it's not about digging and trying to get something. You know, it's, yes, sometimes we've had to, especially with the archive interviews, there are some people that are a little more prickly, the behind the scenes people who don't necessarily want to be in the spotlight can be, you know, you really got to, I interviewed a director once who literally, it was one of my first interviews, and he, every answer was like three words. And Karen at the time was just like, we'd, you know, take a break, and she'd be like, you just have to ask like 15 follow-up questions to try and get him to add more words to the answer. So, that, you know, sometimes you have to be a little bit like persuasive, but we're both pretty much good cop. In business, yeah. If someone has to be the bad cop, that tends to be me.
But. Yeah.
Unless it's about money, and then it tends to be.
Yeah, me. And Nancy is the money bad cop. I don't like to ask for money.
It's good to know your roles.
Yeah, we really do balance each other perfectly. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. It really is.
That's fantastic alchemy. Yeah. I mean, sisters. Mm-hmm. And that's not a guarantee.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, definitely not.
What's your favorite interview question?
Why?
Yeah, why? The Larry King answer is always a good one.
It always makes them think, and usually has the best answer to whatever the topic is.
I like asking celebrity chefs if they could be eating anything anywhere in the world right now, what would they be eating? Because they usually answer like something their grandmother cooked them when they were five.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I like, for a while with the archive interviews, we were asking like comedians what their favorite joke was. And we've heard some, you know, like Fred Willard's joke. I think I've always remembered that, Fred Willard telling us that joke. So go to the archive interview page and look it up. It's funny.
Fred Willard.
Teaser.
Yeah, that's good. Fred Willard was such a gem.
Oh. That was a great day.
Really fun.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been lucky. We've had some great ones.
Mm-hmm. So you've been doing the interviewing. We know you had a partnership. You were selected by Oprah.
Yeah.
The one and only.
The one and only.
Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? Because obviously Oprah is our patron saint.
And it's spectacular.
It was pretty incredible. Do you want to tell the story?
Sure. So at the time, in addition to writing our own blog, we were doing a lot of contributing work to Yahoo. So that gave us a little bit of cachet. And we did a lot of coverage for Oprah's network for OWN when they were just starting out, because there was a moment in time where Oprah, you know, didn't just go from 0 to 100. That network took a while to build, and she was getting a lot of doubt that she was going to pull it off. So she was brilliant, and she went really grassroots. And there's a whole army of Oprah fans who they call themselves the OWN ambassadors, and she basically harnessed them, and they took over social media, and I think turned OWN around to make it what it is today. So we got an email one day that was like, you know, we're doing a press junket for Oprah's Life Class, which was a new show at the time. There's going to be one in Canada, one in St. Louis, one in New York. And we want you guys to participate, but you each, you know, one of you can go to Canada, one of you can go to St. Louis, and one of you can go to New York. And again, we were like, no.
No.
Besides the fact that we're incredibly shy people who don't want to go anywhere without each other, this is our brand. You know, if I walk into a room 9 times out of 10 in a business situation, people literally will be like, hi. You are. If Nancy walks in beside me, they're like, oh, how are you guys? Good to see you, sisters. You know, so this is our brand. This is part of our, you know, I think it's the major secret to our success. So we said, if anybody should understand branding, it's Oprah. And we're only going to do it if we can do it together. We'll pay for one of our own tickets, but you got to let us both do it. So they did. So we ended up doing St. Louis and New York. Got to be in the Rockettes dressing room to, you know, as our green room for the Radio City end of it. But say in St. Louis, we actually got to meet Oprah herself, and it was really intense. And there were about 7 or 8 of us, and they took us into this hallway where we had to stand very quietly because Oprah was finishing up an interview, but it made it feel like you were about to have a meeting with the Pope, you know, who's like, oh my God. And the security people said the only time they'd ever seen so much security was 2 weeks before when Michelle Obama, who was first lady at the time, had been there. So this was like, you know, big deal. And we went in, she was finishing up her interview, and they had a row of seats and couches for all of us. There was a folding chair almost set up right in front of us. And as Oprah walked over to sit down in front of us, the chair magically slid away. And as she sat down, she was like mid-seating, they swept in a big comfy chair under her. And as, literally as she got to that position, the chair was there and she was sitting. It was fantastic. And then she, you know, started talking to us about her experiences. And at one point she said something about how a magazine she worked for had done some kind of like fan, like club kind of thing. And I said, being an interviewer at heart, I said, oh, is that where you got the idea for the book club? And all of a sudden, all these cameras that we didn't know had been videotaping like swooped in on me. And that was when everybody kind of like looked at me. In my head, I hear a gasp. I don't know if there was a gasp, but that was when I realized, oh, we're not supposed to ask questions. We're supposed to listen. And so there was like an awkward moment there. But, you know, she was gracious. She went around the room and she asked everybody what they focused on. And then we got treated like queens. And my rule for the weekend was whatever Oprah gives us to eat, I'm eating it. Whatever she gives us to drink, I'm drinking it. And it was fantastic. You know, we had a great time. So it'll always be a very memorable experience, those 2 weekends.
Yeah. She probably smells amazing, doesn't she? Like, is there just a scent that comes in? I just imagine she like has like a glow, you know.
We didn't get close enough. They definitely wouldn't let us get close enough.
Well, that's not true. That's not true. We did take the picture with her.
Oh, yeah, right.
And honestly, I think I was too overwhelmed.
I was too overwhelmed to remember.
I wasn't thinking that far in advance.
We'll get our big interview and Elizabeth will be over there.
I'll be like,
smell as great as I think she should.
That would have removed us from the building for sure.
I'm sure she does.
Yeah, I'm sure she does. I know someone told us that she doesn't let people use her bars of soap. Like if she has a bar of soap, she doesn't share it. So I'm sure she uses very nice, very fancy hand lotion and, you know, bottled soap, would be my guess.
Yeah. I just imagine her just sort of floating around like a spirit, and your story about the chair arriving just completely confirmed.
Amazing. Yeah. And she had a specific person that like tugged on her dress to make sure it was laying nicely after every commercial break, and took her shoes. She had a shoe person that took her shoes on and off depending on whether she was sitting or standing during the taping.
Yeah, because she doesn't wear her heels during the commercials. She takes her heels off during the commercials.
And when she's sitting down.
Right.
If you're not going to see her feet, she takes off her shoes. She only puts them on if she's standing.
It's an incredibly well-oiled machine that she has built. It's really impressive. And, you know, what was great about that experience really was these OWN ambassadors who we've become friends with a lot of them over the years. They are the nicest people, and you know, we always joke, like, if Oprah used her power for evil, it would be, you know, over, game over. But luckily she has, you know, harnessed this energy to really inspire a lot of people who, you know, have felt hopeless in their life. You know, everybody has a journal. And, you know, one woman, we were sitting there and one total stranger was like, I want you to read my, what I wrote, just wrote in my journal. And it was really like powerful and incredible and intense. And it was like, they just, everybody just wants everybody to thrive and feel good. And we've seen a lot of people whose lives have changed just because they really buy into, and rightly so, kind of the principles that Oprah teaches. So, you know, we get it. We think she's pretty amazing.
Do you feel like that experience empowered you to kind of grow in more to the Passionista project? I mean, was there a little Oprah flavor after you saw?
You know, what's interesting about it is as she went around the room to the seven bloggers that were there, most of the other, I think we were there because we were representing Yahoo. So it was a bigger network. The others were there because they had, like, one was called Positively Positive, and they had all these messages, you know, really deep, meaningful things that they were doing. And she was very drawn to those. When we told her what we did, and, you know, at the time we were doing pop culture, but we always said we're doing pop culture from a positive perspective. We never did trashy stories. We never dug into people's personal lives. It was always from a place of being a fan and, you know, a very positive experience. But she didn't really want to hear any of that. And at the time it was a little crushing because she sort of a little bit dismissed us when we told her what we did. I kind of think in retrospect that stuck in my craw a little bit. And and for a while after that, and actually since then, I always had this longing to do something a little more meaningful. And I think that that may have been the spark for it, that instant where it was like, oh, I'm not doing something important.
Yeah.
And that did lead to starting the Passionistas project, because we just felt like entertainment definitely has its place. We all love it. It's a great escape. But we did, you know, it was 2015, 16. The world was changing. Things were scary. And we really wanted to have more of an impact and do something a little more important. So we knew we wanted to do a podcast, and we didn't want to do just a pop culture podcast. So that's when we decided, you know, all these Me Too stories were coming about, and they were incredibly powerful and important and needed to be told. But we also wanted to tell the stories of women that were thriving and that were rising above some of this stuff. So that's when we started to do the Passionistas Project podcast and interview women that were following their passions in hopes of inspiring other women to do the same thing. So that's sort of where that all came from. But yeah, maybe it did spark from Oprah a little bit.
That's funny. I never thought about it, but I think it did deep down.
I noticed in your interview, looking back through who you've interviewed on the podcast, you have a really diverse body of work. I mean, the women that you're talking to represent a wide variety of life experiences and backgrounds. And is that something that you intentionally had in mind when you started, or was it just kind of where it went naturally?
No, it was definitely our intention. We, first of all, didn't want to do celebrity interviews. We really wanted to use the platform to shine a spotlight on women who don't necessarily get that opportunity or don't get enough of an opportunity. Before we started, we decided that we were going to ask every woman we interviewed to nominate somebody else. And as a result of that, we got connected with women we would never know about. And our favorite story is we went to, you know, we always say, we're going to do your interview on this day. At the end, we're going to ask you to nominate somebody. So we went to this woman, Tess Cacciatore's house, to interview her. And we walked in and she said, oh, you want me to nominate someone, right? And we said, yeah, that, you know, at the end, we'll record you. And she turned and there was a woman sitting in her house. And she said, this is Lina Vola. And when you're done with me, you can interview her. We were like, well, we haven't researched her. We don't know if we want to interview her. And she said, Lynn takes nuclear weapons and melts them down and sculpts peace angels. And we're like, okay, as soon as we're done with you, we're going to interview Lynn, and that would be great. And so we never in a million years would have met Lynn, and we only met Tess because we had interviewed a woman named Madonna Cacciatore, who oddly enough, is not related to Tess, but they met because they both have the last name Cacciatore. So everybody has taken us on these incredible, you know, threads of people that we never in a million years would have found. I think it's become kind of a challenge for people to think of somebody that's like doing something really interesting and unusual. We interviewed someone recently who was shooting. She was like, I know a woman who's a fighter pilot who has Lyme disease and has been battling the healthcare system. We're like, yep. Okay. That sounds like a good one. You know, we are so fortunate that these women trust us to tell their friends and mothers. We've had, well, you know, we had Sashi Chandra nominate her mother, who was amazing. And I think the women let us in because they know we've interviewed someone that they trust. So it gives us some credibility. So our mission is to find people that are doing really unusual things or coming at it from a, you know, a unique perspective or have had some kind of experience in their life that will be informative and inspiring to somebody else. We've been really so lucky with the women that we've been able to meet.
Where did the subscription boxes come in with this?
As we started interviewing all these women, we realized that they not only had amazing stories, but a lot of them had really great products. And we also started to learn a lot of things about how the lack of funding for women-owned businesses and the difficult road that most of these women had starting their own products. So part of our plan was to start a store on our website where we could sell some of these products for them. But once again, Sashi Chandran, who's really one of our guardian angels, we went and met with her and she said, you know what you should do instead of an online website is you should start a subscription box. And we said, what's a subscription box?
We've done a lot of Googling in our career.
Yeah. So we started researching it and realized this is the perfect way to do it. We have a quarterly box. It is filled with products by women-owned businesses and female artisans. And we do all the sourcing ourselves. Beyond just the products, we like our podcast, we tell the story of the women behind the product. So instead of just getting a box with a bunch of makeup in it, you're getting to learn why this woman started the company, what struggles she had starting it, you know, what her passion is. And so you really get to the heart of the products too, which we've had a lot of feedback that that's what women love about it. So yeah, every quarter we have a different box. Every box has a different theme. The summer box is almost sold out. We only have a couple left. So that was exciting for us. And it's been great. It's been a really another amazing way to connect with women. Some of them are women that we've had on the podcast. Some of them we find their product and then we have them on the podcast later. It's a really exciting, fun part of it for us. We get to shop for other people.
Ultimately, it's really about each keeping a box. It'd be much cheaper if we just bought ourselves this stuff.
Yeah. As I hear your story, I feel like you have just crafted this ultimate job for yourselves where it's like feeding all of your passions and building on this foundation. And you've taken the things you love and put them together in a unique package that doesn't fit in any test your kid is going to take in high school. Like, this is the career you should have, but yeah, you're just, you know, truly living your passion. And that's so inspiring.
Yeah, we're really grateful. And we're really lucky that we both discovered we have the same passion at the same time. Yeah. You know, there hasn't been a point really where either one of us is like, I don't want to start a podcast. I don't want to start a subscription box. It's like, yeah, let's do that. So we're really, it's, you know, it's a dream scenario for us to be able to do it together and to both thrive on doing it. And really it's, you know, we've both had career changes a few times throughout our lives and we've both been really passionate about our other careers, but this just feels like it's the one that's going to stick because I can't imagine doing anything else.
It's just so well-timed that we're speaking to you. Like on a personal level, Lisa and I have been, you know, trying to put together something that doesn't fit in a box. Mm-hmm. And to see that you guys have done it and had the success that you've had is exciting and inspiring.
We find with every interview we do, at some point during the course of the interview, the woman we're interviewing says something that's like, that is exactly the message that I needed to hear when I got out of bed this morning. Every single, it's kind of eerie every single time. So maybe this is what you needed to hear.
I guess you're just going around delivering magic. That's your real job.
I'm curious about your evolution as you've continued to evolve what it is you do and how you do it and the different career transitions that you've had. One of the things that Elizabeth and I have talked about is that scary leap, knowing that where you are isn't working, but where you need to go, you're not quite sure how you get from here to there. And you've both mentioned multiple times how much learning you've had, but there's scariness in kind of taking that leap. And I'm curious, what sort of self-talk or how were you each kind of motivating the other and cheering each other on that we're going to do this and we can do this. I know that, you know, there are those moments where it's just, it feels like I know where I want to go, but it's really hard. And one of the things that we really like to hear is not just, we did it and everything's fantastic, but it was hard. And here's what was hard about it. And here's how we showed up for each other. Can you talk a little bit about some of those transitions that you've had in your careers?
I have to say, I've always been an entrepreneur. There were those 3 years that I worked at the ad agency. So I have a slightly different perspective on it than Amy. And I think that actually helps because, you know, I always say to her, the money will come when it needs to come. It always has. I've been self-employed my entire life, and something always happens when you need it to happen. And I believe that. And I think I've gotten her to pretty much believe it.
I pretty much do. This morning was, I definitely had a morning today where it was like, all right, the morning money's going to come. Yeah, I think that's my biggest concern.
We definitely have highs and lows. And, you know, quite honestly, we don't make a living at the Passionistas Project. You know, we still have clients. We still work for the Television Academy. We still have other clients. We work for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We work for a bunch of other people. Even we have not taken the 100% leap where we cut the cord and, you know, we're going to make the Passionistas Project our, you know, full-time business. I mean, that's our goal. That's what we want. But, you know, there is still a little bit of fear holding us back from the point where we say we don't need that safety net anymore, you know? So, you know, it's a constant struggle and it's a lot of work. But I think that what keeps us going is we do have each other, and we almost always have our good days and bad days opposite one another. So there's very rarely a day where we're both like, oh, this is never going to work. So we can cheer the other one on and get her off the ledge and keep going. You know,
I also just think we're really determined to make it work. Like I said, like I don't want to do anything else with my life. I want to make this happen. So we are going to make it happen. Like, we just have to. I feel like it's not a question of like, oh, should we try this or not? It's like, no, we have to figure this out. Like, we have to figure this out right away. And I also think that, you know, we're good Catholic school girls. So if we get an assignment, we do it that night and we don't wait until the night before it's due to, you know, start writing our paper. I did that once. It was a miserable experience, and I remember it to this day, even though I was in fourth grade. And so for us, it's like we have an idea, we dive right into it, and we just keep working and working and working and coming at it in every way we need to until we solve the problem or move the agenda ahead or get the commitment that we need. So for me, it's if I stop and step back and go like, what are we doing? Why do we think we're the people capable of pulling this off? Then I might have a second to doubt it. And I don't have the luxury of doing that. I'm determined. I think Nancy feels the same way.
Do you have anyone on your list that would be your dream interview?
Oprah would be good.
I'd actually be terrified to interview Oprah.
Oh, I would love it. Let me at her. I would love it. I think we both would love to interview Jane Goodall. I think she's probably top number one person on our list. We're monkey people, so we would love to interview her. Yep. You know, I'd love to sit down and have a chat with Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, I would love to talk to Michelle Obama. I would love to talk to Kamala Harris on a realistic level.
Katie Porter.
Katie Porter.
yeah. Yeah, you know, honestly, like we've been able to interview some of those people. So, and now like my mind is so women centric that I only think of women like, oh, we might be able to interview women. But, you know, we've interviewed Carol Burnett. We've interviewed Julie Louis-Dreyfus. We've interviewed Laverne and Shirley, you know, so a lot of our boxes have been ticked, you know, and we're really lucky and grateful for that. So, yeah, if anyone wants to get us to Jane Goodall, that'd be fantastic.
I actually have a connection. I have 2 degrees to Jane Goodall.
Oh,
so
my God. See?
I'm going to send you.
You just have to put it out in the universe.
That's true, right?
We are firm believers in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fun. I was just continually thinking about, you were in the same space as Oprah. And I really liked how you took the feeling of almost, and this is a tough word, but almost that dismissive feeling of, she's not validating what we are doing right now as meaningful and impactful. We believe we are, and we're going to continue to evolve that. I love that. And I actually think that's a story that should be told with Oprah, you know, because yeah, right. All you ever hear is that Oprah is this inspiration and she's, you know, this springboard for other women. And I don't know that we always understand even our body language or the words that we use, how that may affect how someone else reacts to that. And she probably has no idea that she did that and what the effect was, but look at what you're doing. And whether you directly link it or not, you are absolutely helping women to thrive in such tangible ways. And that is what I think she wants her legacy to be. But I just envision, as I'm sitting here listening, I envision this interview with the two of you and Oprah, and this story comes out, and then you're able to really be able to share what, you know, incredible impact you are making on this world as it relates to women in particular. So.
Yeah. I mean, there's no denying that, you know, seeing somebody like her who does good, you know, whatever other stuff comes along with that is, it's inspiring. And to watch a room, you know, a theater full of people react to her message is like, it's life changing to, I think, that moment with her, but also just the experience of seeing what you can do for other people's lives was definitely impactful too. I mean, it's fun to, you know, entertain people and tell stories and have interviews, and we love doing that. But what we've been doing for the last 2 years has changed our lives completely. And planning this event we have coming up, like, we're blown away by how supportive this community of women that we are building is, not only with each other, but with us. And we're reaping the benefits of, in a way that we never expected. So we're lucky. Yeah.
Let's get into the Women's Equity Summit. What can you tell us about that? That's coming up.
We, you know, about a year ago, started realizing that this year is the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote. And we knew we wanted to do something to mark the occasion. We originally thought it would be a live in-person event in Los Angeles, like a one-day event. Obviously, the universe had other plans, so we took it virtual. And we also wanted to acknowledge the fact that, yes, 100 years ago, some women got the right to vote, but not all women got the right to vote. And with everything that's been going on lately, we really wanted to make sure that we touched on all aspects of equality for women. So we're making it as diverse and inclusive as we possibly can. It's going to be a 3-day event. We went from, we'll have a couple panels to, the list is so long now. We have 4 live panels. So there will be a LGBTQ+ panel. There'll be a voter equality panel. There's a financial workplace equality panel. And there's a racial equality panel. We have 3 workshops. One will be about voting.
One is by a woman named Dia Bondi, and it's called Ask Like an Auctioneer. And she's a communications coach for like presidents and Olympic councils. But she also is in her spare time, is a auctioneer for charity events. And she realized that women have a hard time asking for things because we're all trained to ask because we want a yes. And an auctioneer asks until they get a no. And so she's come up with this system of asking called Ask Like an Auctioneer. So she's going to do her workshop for us. And then we have another woman named Megan Hamilton, who's going to do a workshop for women about public speaking and just helping to coach women on public speaking. Yeah. So the workshops are going to be really interesting. And the voting workshop is great. It's actually a woman named Jessica Craven, who has a daily email called Chop Wood, Carry Water. And she blasts out, it'll take you 5 minutes, do these three things, text message your representatives about this topic, email them about this topic. And so it's just like a 5 minute daily thing that you can do to make change. So she's doing a workshop called Activism 101. And she's going to teach people about text banking and writing postcards and how they can get out for the vote in 2020.
So then we also have, I think right now it's up to 20 presentations. So those will be pre-recorded presentations that you can access throughout the whole weekend on various aspects of equality, from like ageism to sizeism. There's a woman who's going to be talking about education for children, getting kids who are interested in being activists but don't know where to start. And then on Friday evening, thanks to Elizabeth Holmes, we are doing a LunaFest, which we know you guys partook in the LunaFest a few years ago. Such an incredible organization. And so Friday evening, we're presenting the 2020 LunaFest with 7 short films by women all about equality. Coincidentally, that's their theme this year.
Isn't that great? Oh, wow.
And then Saturday evening, we're having a storyteller event, and we have 7 women that are going to be telling their own personal stories about equality.
And both of those are followed with Q&As.
Q&As.
Q&As with the filmmakers, Q&As with the storytellers.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is content rich. My gosh.
And then we have a virtual marketplace where many of them are women that we've had in the subscription box or interviewed. So we'll link out to their websites or social media presences, and they can either just have their store, or if they want to be doing a live presentation during a certain block of time on Saturday and Sunday, Lisa Barbosa, who does crochet, is going to be on, and she may have a live video where she's showing people her technique. And then we're doing a similar thing that we're calling the Pay It Forward portal, and that's going to be for philanthropic organizations to promote the work that they're doing. And we're sponsored by Tea Drops, which is Sashi Chandran's company, and LunaFest is sponsored by Luna. Oh, we are donating part of the proceeds to Girls Inc. and to Black Girls Code. But it's free. The weekend is free for anybody that registers. And then there are upgrades that they can choose. But anybody can tune in. Men, women, you know, we want men to hear what all us ladies have to say. So everybody's welcome. And that's... I think that's everything we have planned so far.
I think that's it.
You register through your website? Is that where?
If you go to our website, there's a link out to the registration. We're working with a portal called virtualsummits.com. So it's this nice, everything's just drag and drop. It's all set up. That's where it's hosted. So, but if you go to our website, you can get a link out to there.
And we'll have a link to your website in the show notes when it's published.
Appreciate that.
I love your guys' attitude of like, let's put on a show.
It's in our blood. I mean,
it's in our blood.
It's we were playing Lost in Space in the dining room when we were
You know? You're just like, yeah, we haven't done this before. So,
and it's like, you know, just the idea that we're not just going to do an event, we're going to do like an event. Like, everyone was like, maybe you should just think about, you know, one or two panels and ease into it. And we're like, no.
You're like, hell no, we're Harringtons.
Exactly. We don't go small. I knew it was bad when we, Madonna Cacciatore, who is the director of Christopher Street West and LA Pride, and is going to run, she's going to moderate our LGBTQ+ panel. And we talked to her last week and we told her all of that. And, you know, this is a woman who organized the week-long Pride festivities last year with concerts with, you know, major stars and parades and, you know, different events every night. And we told her and she was like, that's a lot. I was like, oh no.
What have we done?
She thinks it's a lot. We're in trouble.
That sounds familiar, doesn't it, Lisa?
What's up?
Yeah.
Let's publish.
I think we're a little, maybe not quite as ready for the big show.
No, I just feel like kindred spirits, and that
yes,
big idea. Yeah, and we haven't really cared that we haven't done it before. It's like, yeah. We'll figure it out.
We always figure other people have done it. If they could figure it out, we could figure it out. And, you know, there's so much tech support now. And there's so many, you know, I think the scariest thing for us was like, we had done a seminar where they were like, you know, you'll reach out to five people, you'll get one yes out of every five people. So we were like, how are we going to put this together and get enough people to participate and have it be diverse enough? You know, we wanted diversity in terms of people's backgrounds and in terms of topics. And we were really worried about that. And I would say 4 out of 5 people have said yes.
Oh, at least. I think we've only gotten 3 or 4 no's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So every woman that we've approached has been really excited about it. And like with the podcast, we'll talk to somebody and they'll say, oh, you know, I know someone that might be able to talk about this. And so we've, you know, and on Facebook, we've found women. So I would say half of the women are people we've never met before. I know we've got a woman in India who's going to participate and a woman in Italy that's going to participate. The range of people and the range of topics, the topics that never in a million years we would have thought of to discuss, is fascinating. And like with the podcast, we want everyone to tell their story. We don't want it to be us saying, like, here's what I think about racial equality. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, that's not my place. So we're saying to everybody, like, what, I don't know, what does equality mean to you? Talk about that. So everybody's really grateful that we're not dictating the topics. And I think as a result, like, the stories that people are, we've had a lot of women say, I've been wanting to tell this story for a long time. And now I will. Now I'll finally come out and talk about it. It's going to be pretty spectacular, I think.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you think the pandemic had any effect on... Yeah, you're both nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, that's a really helpful thing for us.
I'm just like trying to find a silver lining in this pandemic wherever I can.
It absolutely has. I think, like we said, originally this was going to be like probably a 3 or 4 hour event in Los Angeles. So we were counting on, you know, getting a couple of, you know, half a dozen people that we know to come to be on panels and work from our pool of people in Los Angeles to come and attend it. Now we're talking with people in India and Italy, and, you know, we're going to be able, anyone from around the world can come and watch the panels and listen. And it really, and I think also the fact that the presenters are cooped up and have more time on their hands and are willing. Everybody knows Zoom now. There's not a person on the planet, including my 88-year-old mother-in-law, who hasn't been on Zoom in the last couple months. So it's not intimidating to people anymore. So I think that, you know, everyone is in the right space for it. And just what's going on in the world, I think everyone is just inspired to make change and do something. I think everybody wants to do something, you know, and that's sort of, that's what the other thing we've been saying to all our panelists is, we don't want this to just be a weekend where everyone tells this story and the attendees go, oh, what a great story, and go back to their lives. We want every panel and every presentation to give somebody a concrete idea or step or action that they can take and actually to make change, whether that's voting or whether that's how they interact with someone at the office or whatever it is that they can take away from it. But we want every single panel to really inspire people to change, not just to hear a great story.
One of the things that I think is an advantage with the pandemic is equality is also about inclusion, and it's not as inclusionary to have it in one location. Like Elizabeth and I can call in. We wouldn't probably get on a flight and head down to LA. And so if really the goal is to celebrate equality and to understand what that means, this is a great way to really, you know, open that circle to be really, truly inclusive. And I agree with Elizabeth that even though there's been a lot of terrible things that have been the result of this pandemic, there's also been just some beautiful things that I think are coming out of this time period. And this is definitely going to be one of those. I mean, your lineup is phenomenal. Like, I can't wait. And the question's going to be, which of each of these sessions, how am I going to make a choice? Which one to be a part of and to watch? And I love the focus on being able to take action, because I find that while it's amazing in that moment to be inspired, it's another thing to change how we act and interact. And you have such a great opportunity to help catalyze change. So it's going to be awesome. I can't wait. And we're going to do our part to put that out.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate that, because we really want to try and reach as many women as possible and men as possible. The LA Pride this year was interesting because they couldn't do the parade, and that was worldwide. And so World Pride, I don't know if you saw it, but World Pride did this streamed event, which was people from LGBTQ communities around the world. So you would see someone in India and you would see someone in, Guatemala. So when we finally connected with this woman from India the other day, we were so excited because she's going to talk about what equality is like in India and the government and the, being a woman. And it's like, not that that's a personal experience everybody connects to on the, they live in different places, but it's such a universal conversation. So to be able to expand it to, include India and Italy, and who knows, we still have time, maybe some other places. We're really, really thrilled that that's just a bonus of the pandemic end of it that we never anticipated. So, and in terms of what to watch, we did struggle with how much to do and how, whether it was too much. But we also figured the panels are live. If you want to tune into a panel you connect with, you have to tune in at a particular time. But for 3 days, everything else is going to be up on the platform. And you can, if you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, rather than putting on the British baking show that I've been watching, maybe tune into the woman from India and see what she has to say.
So exciting. So we like to ask this question. Taking a little pivot here. How do you define success now, and how is it different for you when you were younger?
It's always sort of been the same for me, I think, because I've always placed happiness and quality of life over money. So success to me has never really been about money. But I do have to say, I was recalling a time back when we were starting that cable network. I had just bought my first Mini Cooper, which I loved. I loved my Mini Cooper. And my goal when we were working on this cable network was to have a fleet of Mini Coopers so that I could have a different color for every day of the week. That was my big financial goal. And that did not come to play. And now I realize that that's fine. But to me, success has always been more about quality of life, enjoying what you do, being passionate about what you do, wanting to get up every day and do that. I have to go to work, but I get to go to work. And, spending time with family and friends and loved ones. And that to me is success.
Yeah, it's super cliche, but definitely finding balance and having freedom are, to me, our success now. When I worked at Warner Brothers, especially, it was all consuming, completely focused on work. I had friends. I didn't really have family here because Nancy didn't move till the tail end of Warner Brothers. So I was 100% about work, and I loved it. It was my driving passion. I loved every second of it for most of the time. But I didn't have much of a personal life to speak of, and I was completely at the whim of the studio and my bosses. And now that I have the freedom to live my life and to make the choices that I'm making, I am much happier. And as long as I can keep doing what I'm doing and have the freedom to do it, I love being location independent. That's really critical to me. I feel like we're really successful right now.
That's wonderful.
Awesome. I just have one more question, and I know that we have already kept you for a little bit longer than the hour. We also like to ask what advice you might have given your younger self.
Calm the F down. Calm down. You'll be all right. No, I'm serious to a fault a lot of the time. I'm very passionate about things, so I get very intense. And I would tell myself that it's, you know, don't take it so seriously. Enjoy it. Enjoy it more. Don't worry about the details.
I think for me, I was a really shy kid. I'm a pretty shy adult. And I think they're not looking at you. Nobody out there is thinking about you. Just do your thing. You're doing, do a great job. And because I was always so worried about what people were thinking, what were they going to say? What were they going to, you know, they're not thinking about you.
Those are great.
That's awesome. Yeah. Advice really for today. Still applicable.
Well, thank you both so much for your time. We appreciate you going over, staying a little longer with us. I could have talked to you all day.
Flew by. I didn't even realize how long. I have no idea what time it is. So thank you both for having us. We love what you're doing, and we really appreciate that you would even want to talk to us about our stuff. So.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I agree with Elizabeth. Like, I have a ton of questions, but you know, respect your time and huge admiration to both of you. And and we're watching and cheering you on from Vancouver, Washington.
We love Vancouver.
Yeah. Next time we're up there in person, we'll get together for a drink.
Yes.
That'd be awesome.
2021. Yeah. Not one.
Thank you so much for listening. If you tuned into our first season, you know we believe in shining the light on women's stories. Please help us to illuminate women's stories by changing the storytellers. While we tend to shy away from self-promotion, we're flipping the script and embracing our awesomeness and getting comfortable telling others about the great things we are up to. Check us out at trusttreegroup.com. All our links are there and you can buy some really cool shit. Subscribe to our podcast and share the podcast with your friends and leave us 5-star reviews because we need external validation. Introduce us to women with stories that need to be told. Sign up for our newsletter, follow us on social media, and look for our candles in our online shop or at the Vanwares kiosk in Divine Consign on Main Street. I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Lisa.
And together we are Trust Tree.